We will call the Senate Special Committee on Healthcare Reform to order. Today is April 11th. We will continue our public hearing on Senate Bill 329 for the specific purpose of receiving testimony on the Dash 2 amendments. We have a lengthy list of testifiers tonight. I think we should be able to get through everyone. I apologize for the late start, but the House is still in their subcommittee. For those of you that are new this evening joining us, we traditionally have had the House Subcommittee on Healthcare Reform join us, so we have a bicameral deliberative process here. Before I begin, I just want to say I very much appreciate each and every one of your not only attendance but continued attendance. And what we have before us tonight is the work and represents the long labors of many people that are very concerned and committed to reforming health care in this state. We still see it as a living document. That's why the public testimony is so important. I mean, some parts will grow and expand. Others will atrophy. Some new ones will perhaps appear, and some parts of the bill might even disappear. So this is an ongoing process, but again, we have just four meetings left after tonight, and so this we need to be precise, we need to be consistent, and we, as the old saying goes, get the cart down the road. I'd like to turn it over to my August co-chair, see if he has any opening remarks.
Just a very few. Again, thank you everyone for coming in. I know these 5 o'clock meetings are difficult for your families and for your personal life, but I appreciate you coming in. We are extremely interested in your testimony tonight and the next few nights. We are going to condense what we would normally do probably over a period of 4 weeks into about a week, week and a half. And we have to get this bill out and ready to go. This is accumulation of work that's been done for the last year and a half at this time. There are areas where I think we still need to make changes, as my good coach here has already talked about. We are going to take your comments very seriously. Very seriously. I know there's things we've probably left out, things we put in that may need to come out, things that may need to be altered, some word crafting to be obtained. The basic principles are here, though. A management board, if you will, a trust board, if you will, start bringing some order out of the chaos of our healthcare system in Oregon to move us to universal access, hopefully in 2009, cost control in 2009, and better outcomes. Mr. Chair, the meeting is yours.
Well, with that, let's just get started. I know some of you have tight schedules, and I've got an order here. So let's just start right off the bat with Dr. Mark Richardson, Dean of OSU School of Medicine. Thanks for coming down, Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairs and committee members, for allowing me to speak to you today. I do appreciate the opportunity to testify before you about the Oregon Better Health Act. And obviously, as dean of the School of Medicine, the only medical school in Oregon, and, of course, a concerned citizen, I'm deeply interested in this and in all reform efforts. I'm really here not to talk about so much about the deliberations that you'll undertake as it relates to a reform, but I do want to say that we agree with you totally with the summary language that is in the bill that stipulates improving and protecting the health of all Oregonians must be a primary issue and an important goal of the state. That's something that OHSU has believed in and long held to be the case, and I want to congratulate you all on initiating this effort. I'm gratified by the acknowledgement in this bill that there is a need for a reevaluation of healthcare finance, and I have confidence that within Oregon's culture and history of collaboration on healthcare issues, we'll find that consensus of social values about healthcare access in the shape of reform. But we also believe that any lasting and sustainable model of quality healthcare should factor these following issues into shaping the solution. One is that we think that support for the education and training of Oregon's healthcare workforce is integral to your reform. Healthcare access requires provider availability and accessibility as well as finance. I know that may be taken as somewhat provincial coming from a medical school, but it's not just the physicians. It really is healthcare providers that go all the way from our allied health personnel through nurses as well as physicians, physicians assistants, dentists, dental technicians. We all need to support the education of those professionals who will help take care of the patients that need their services. Two, I think once we graduate from whatever program we do to help provide health care, that does not end our education or measure our ultimate effectiveness. We need, I think, to continue to think about how we can make sure that the healthcare providers that are being utilized in the state are of the highest quality and effectiveness. That requires funding, I think, to make sure that our providers are of the utmost abilities. Three, the efficiency, and Senator Westland, you mentioned outcomes improvement, really depends on, to a certain extent, innovation of delivery models and innovation in healthcare itself. Traditionally, some of the things that have had some of the greatest impact on outcomes really have not been well supported in terms of finance. I'll just mention as example screening methodologies, multidisciplinary care of the aged and those individuals with complex diseases, new drugs, new regimens of care, all need support, I think, if we're really going to obtain the best outcomes and the best effect from the dollars that you're going to utilize in your plan. And four, and I know this is part of your plan, and that is to maintain funding for graduate medical education and the disproportionate share provisions of Medicaid. Any disruption, and I mention that simply because any disruption of that has significant ripple effects that takes a toll on provision of care at every institution in the state. I'd also like to just mention that I think OHSU has a contribution to make helping you with your deliberations, and I hope that you will call on us if there's any thing that we can do. And I'd like to thank you very much for the opportunity to provide my testimony to you today. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Dr. Bates.
Dr. Richardson, thank you for coming down today, and I appreciate your presence here. I'd like to ask you to do two things for us in the future, or do it in writing, not tonight. One is that we believe that the need for primary care and the treatment of long-term chronic illnesses and preventative care is the key to bringing healthcare costs down. And to do that, we have to have more primary care physicians. We know right now that in many medical schools, I'm not sure at ours, that the vast majority of those students are not going into primary care because the incentives are not there to go into primary care. The other problem is retention of students from the medical school. They graduate with a heavy burden and then have many options across the country, some of which are much more lucrative than what we offer in Oregon, and we lose probably half those students, maybe less, maybe more, I don't know. But it's a significant number. Could you present to us at a later time in writing those things you think what incentives we could change that would make a difference for keeping students here and direct them towards primary care? I think of things like supplements for their malpractice insurance and high-risk areas, OB, or supplements for going into rural areas, or some kind of a payback program for going into rural areas or other areas that need them in the state. So I don't expect an answer now. But if you agree with that type of change as far as the incentives are concerned, I'd love to have something in writing about that.
I'd be happy to do so. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
And we do consider you a resource, without question.
Good.
And your evidence-based center, I mean, it goes on and on. All right. See, no other questions?
Thank you
again, sir. Let me call up two people that probably didn't realize they're going to testify together, but they may have met one another. How about Dave Ford from CARE Oregon and Thomas Ashenbrenner from the Northwest Health Foundation? I hope this is not violating some protocol here.
I don't think so.
Get you two at the same dais.
Mr. Ford and I are the best of friends.
This is,
and collaborating.
This is our chance.
Uh-oh.
Enter and sign in, please. Pick your poison. Who wants to go first?
Did someone lock the doors?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that is certainly age before beauty going there. I'll tell you that right
now. I'm Dave Ford, President and CEO of CARE Oregon. And as you know, we provide coverage for about 100,000 Medicaid and dual-eligible Medicare folks. And what you're doing is close to our heart because we see daily what the effect of people are who lose coverage and don't have it, and the huge ramifications of that. We're very pleased with the evolution of this legislation. It has had many fingerprints and a lot of consequential work in the deliberation process and changes. We've provided a lens that we've been looking at the bill through and studying it and all the other bills that have been put together, as well as what's been done nationally. And the template is based on the Institute of Medicine's book around changing the healthcare structures. Virtually all the elements that the template has been developed are hit by this, and you added a number of adaptations to the National Institute of Medicine's model to fit Oregon, including all the safety and the six quality criteria of the Institute of Medicine's crossing the quality chasm. So this is not just something that we've developed in Oregon. This is a national, I think, breakthrough bill in terms of the form that you've really worked through in the last year. One of the key elements that is missing from a lot of other bills, we think, nationally, is the work around what Dean Richardson said, innovative models of healthcare and innovation, and you hit a lot of those. One of the problems we have is that the payment structures for healthcare fit last generation's models and not what we need in the future. So the efficiency, effectiveness, safety, integration have been missing in the payment structures. And one of the things that we would encourage is not only is this a payment reform, but really a delivery reform and a product of medical product reform consistent with the national mandate. So we're very pleased to see you working through. I know this has not been your intent, but it's been fully threaded through your work. Our sense is that lays a very solid foundation from which to move forward into 2009. You can't build a large structure and a comprehensive structure without a foundation like you're talking about. And We could comment about a few details. We'll dialogue with you over those. We would like to see some mandates around both employers and individuals so that people do have incentives to be part of the system, consistent with what we've seen in Massachusetts. I know those are tricky issues to work through, but we think that, it's an all-player kind of situation. We're pleased to see that you're open to local infrastructures, such as the fully capitated plans, being part of the delivery system, and echo that we have a very strong infrastructure in Oregon that's unique to Oregon that we ought to leverage. And I won't take a lot of time, but I'd compliment you. And again, we and other people that we're working with would be more than honored to be resources for you guys as you carry it to the next level.
Thank you for those words, Dave. More importantly, thank you for all of your extraordinary work in this field. Any questions?
Just a question. I want to thank you, Mr. Ford, for being here. Clarify again what you said, that this bill was based on old... what?
Part of... not the bill. The current delivery system is... how we pay for health care is built on a coding structure that was appropriate for the late 80s and 90s. We do not have coding structures to pay for medicine as it needs to be in the future, and we need to be able to be thoughtful about evolving not only infrastructure but how we compensate providers to change to a more performance-based, a more accountable, and a safer system. Yes.
Any other questions?
Just for clarification, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for clarification, when you say coding, I think I know exactly what you mean. Oh. IC9 and CPT
right.
codes. Many people may not know what those are, and what they basically are, and correct me again if I'm wrong, I use them from one end, you may look at a different point. When a patient is seen by a provider, they have to supply a code for that particular diagnosis or what they did. You write the code in and you get paid. And what I believe you're talking about is we're not as concerned about the code you use as what the outcome of that visit was. Did the patient's blood pressure come under control? Did the patient's diabetes come under control? What is really happening? Not just, I saw a patient for 15 minutes. This is the code I used. This is what I got paid.
Precisely. And what Dean Richardson was saying is we need innovative new models that pay for preventive care and do that strongly and allocate services and reward services in the primary care area as well. And we're not well-suited to pay for that kind of activity as well as we pay for procedural kinds of medicine.
Thomas?
Thank you, Chairs Bates and Westland. Thank you so very much for the opportunity to speak to you and the members of the committee today. My name is Thomas Ashenbrenner. I'm president of the Northwest Health Foundation. And I'd like to share our foundation's perspectives on Senate Bill 329. Most of you know our founding board chair, Senator Mark Hatfield. Senator Hatfield, in working with me, said several times that you cannot build a strong nation, a nation that is strong economically, strong politically, strong militarily, strong spiritually, on the backs of sick people. He used that as the basis for guiding us through our first steps of developing our guiding principle. And our first guiding principle that he brought to us was that access to quality health care is a basic right of all people. From this perspective, we have been moving forward and addressing this issue for a very long time. For several months now, we have been saying that now is the time for health care reform in Oregon, and we believe that Senate Bill 329 is a very promising first step towards this goal. We are very pleased to see that you have merged pieces of the different health reform efforts in this legislation, such as those from the Archimedes movement and the plans from the Oregon Health Policy Commission and the Oregon Business Council. The foundation is very supportive of this type of collaborative work. As you know, over the past year, the foundation and the Oregon Health Policy Commission have been convening the Oregon Health Reform Collaborative. And this is comprised of organizations representing consumers, businesses, providers, labor, insurers, and key legislative staff. The membership continues to grow today in this health reform collaborative. And which may seem a little unusual given the disparate groups that have come together, all addressing the same issue. A few weeks ago, we shared with you the consensus statements that came out of the Oregon Health Reform Collaborative, which includes a broad set of principles necessary for steps for health reform in Oregon. We are pleased to see that there are numerous parallels between these principles and what is laid out in Senate Bill 329. Another one of the Foundation's guiding principles is that a robust public health system is a vital component of a healthy community. We recognize that you can put an unlimited amount of money into health care, but the health of the people won't improve until you focus on public health. Very important. You can put all the money you want into health care. It does not improve the health of the people as much as public health does. And we are very pleased to see that Senate Bill 329 mentions that public health policies should be emphasized in the work that goes forward. The Northwest Health Foundation is supportive of a number of other features in the bill. For example, we appreciate that the board membership will include voices of consumers and will engage representatives from geographic and ethnic diverse communities in the state. We agree that the Oregon Health Trust Board needs to broadly represent the best thinking in our state and conduct public hearings and solicit testimony and also seek direct input from people who can help advance this plan. We know at the foundation that in order to do something right, you have to pay for it. That is the essence of how we work in our community. I understand that financing this bill is not part of this committee's work, but that we hope that you will lay the groundwork for ensuring that the Oregon Health Trust Board is adequately staffed and funded. It is our opinion that the staff and staff leadership will be key in making this work, while the board will be responsible for providing overall policy direction. We don't expect this bill to be perfect. We do expect that all of us, working in good faith, that this bill can be moved forward and we can learn from the experiences and modifications can be made in the future. Senator Bates mentioned something very important to us just a few minutes ago, and I thank you for that, Senator. I do want to draw your particular attention to the importance of providing greater support and equitable resources for primary care and prevention. These are very much under-resourced in our current system and are an essential part of assuring the health of our community. In addition, in primary care and prevention, there is much to be gained by making certain that the valuable role of nurses is included as part of the primary care team in the reformed health care system. Finally, we must not overlook the very real issues of health disparities in Oregon. We trust that the board and its subcommittees will be appropriately tasked to create real answers and strategies on these issues. While we are supportive of Senate Bill 329, which puts in place activities that can happen now in Oregon to reform health care system, we know that real systemic change can only happen if we address these problems at the national level. Thus, we are also supportive of Senate Bill 27, which looks forward to the future and brings hope to have the health reform conversations at the national level. We believe that the leadership on the national health reform will occur through the convergence of efforts at the state level as proposed by Senate Bill 329 and those at the national level proposed by Senate Bill 27. In conclusion, I want to assure the committee that the Northwest Health Foundation has no constituency other than the people of Oregon. We operate on our own assets. We do not raise money from others. We do not have any business interest to defend or promote, nor any political interest to defend or promote. We do recognize that to move forward with reform in Oregon and eventually on the national level, that all stakeholders need to approach this effort from the perspective of asking of themselves, what can I give up for the common goal? We know that you will have oppositional forces seeking power over decision-making and financial gains from this legislation. But it is only through the building of goodwill for the common good that we will find a way forward to a healthy society. We cannot be paralyzed by fear of change. What is important is that we start today to work together as Oregonians to do something to fix our broken health system. And I want to thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you for your very wise words, Thomas. And it should warm your heart a little bit to know that Chris DeMars and Gretchen Morley from Oregon, from Uper, gave us a presentation on your principles. So
I know,
sir. They have been included. Representative Greenland.
Good evening, sir.
You know, I saw this blazing flash come across.
I'm down to 10-8 in 100 yard now. I expect to get under 9 minutes any time. Thomas, I'd like to ask you a question. You can forget that you're being asked by a board member. You suggest support both for 329 and for 27. 27 sets up an administrative structure to do similar things to the administrative structure set up in 329. Are you proposing that there be these parallel competing administrative structures set up under the two bills?
Through the co-chairs to Representative Greenlake, I think that where we are coming down on this is that we want to find a way to create the national conversation. I think that the support is for the principles contained in Senate Bill 27, and with the recognition that the structures may indeed need to be addressed a little differently than what is there at this time. I think that the important piece is that the intent is that we not delude ourselves to thinking that we can do this alone in Oregon. It isn't going to happen that way.
Absolutely.
And that we must keep our eye on what we can do at the national level as well. And so it is from that perspective that we are supporting both bills.
That might argue for 329 going forward in this form and the waiver request of 27 going forward, which is something that I suggested for some time, so we can discuss the waivers, which would support what we're trying to do in 329, and that may be something we can work out.
Good question.
Thomas, thank you for coming. You know how important I think the public policy role of the foundation is, and I appreciate your supporting that.
Any further questions? Senator Bates.
Chair, this is a question for both David and Thomas. I'm going to ask you to focus on one part of the bill just for a moment, and if you feel comfortable giving an answer now, do so. If not, get back to us later. One of the key components of this bill is the makeup of the trust board. This has been an evolving process for a year and a half, and we've struggled with this for a year and a half. Some of us feel, and I would have to say that I'm in that camp, that we need a transitional board to report back to the legislature in January of 2009. And that transitional board might be a little larger than the one we're talking about here.
would be made up of certain prominent and well-trusted Oregonians, some of whom might be sitting very close to me right now, looking back at my eyes, and others who have expertise in healthcare delivery systems. So we have a combination, a sprinkling of both those who are well-trusted and thought of in the state, as well as those who have good expertise in healthcare, so that the ability to bring those people up to speed that aren't maybe as well-versed would be there. That transitional board could be bringing back to the Legislative Assembly in 2009 the fruition of 329, a matured plan, one in which the many threads of the cloth we've talked about are completed in it, with some very specific things need to be done to implement a plan, which would be universal access to Oregon, beginnings of cost control, and better outcomes, which might also ultimately lead in the next few years to a discussion at a different level as far as, frankly, Medicare is concerned. Many of us feel Medicare is a problem that has to be dealt with, but we have to learn to walk before we run. And that means learning how to deal with the system that we have now that can make it effective and workable. So my question to you after all that is, have you had thoughts about what that board should look like, the kind of people that should be on it, and is it a doable process for them in the short time available between now and the 2009 assembly to obtain and get that work done?
I think it's precisely what needs to be done, is you do need to have a group that can spend time, work down at a level of detail that's significant, that fits the Oregon model, but it needs to have sufficient staffing and resources to actually do the work. If it's a public board of people who come with other duties, there needs to be the ability to do the homework and the preparation and bring in outside resources to actually make it work. The only way and the only seriousness to do this is to do it right and to resource it, and it's going to take a lot of levels of commitment, including the legislature, to fund it properly and then find the right people to be committed and drive it through to give a comprehensive solution for Oregon. And as far as the details of that, we can get back to you offline.
Thank you.
Chairman Bates, I would completely echo and agree with what Mr. Ford has said, and I would add another couple of thoughts to it, and that is that I would urge you to have people on that board who are capable people but who are not the usual suspects, or you will get the usual answers. And I think there are people in this state, and there are people possibly who can bring new, fresh ideas, who may not have spent a lot of time working in governmental entities, but who understand the issues that need to be addressed. You know, one of the things that I have found for the very longest time in the mental health arena is that sometimes when you talk with the leadership of all of the organizations and societies and the governmental entities about mental health, you get all of these suggestions of what you can do. But when you get down and start talking to the people who are delivering the services, they know exactly what needs to be done and what is going to make a difference in the lives of those people. So my suggestion is that we look for opportunities to have the people who really understand what the delivery systems are like in participating in what the patients need. Again, I echo your comments around prevention and public health or primary care. I think that we are we are not doing ourselves a service if we don't recognize that with the aging of the population, we are seeing an increase in chronic care. And chronic care and chronic care management occurs primarily in the primary care physician's office and within that physician-nurse team. And so we really need to pay a lot more attention. I can tell you, you can ask any primary care physician about their reimbursement versus those of their colleagues who are in specialty care. And, I mean, it's pretty appalling. They're not getting what they need to deliver good care. And what is included, what is not included. And I really think that is an area that needs to be addressed very seriously.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Gentlemen,
thank you
so very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to call Gerald Cohen and Rick Bennett, please.
Get the big fella next to the little fella. Chairman Westland, Chairman Bates, and distinguished members of this esteemed committee. I am, for the record, Gerald J. Cohen, Jerry Cohen, resident of Lake Oswego, but I'm here speaking as the state director for AARP Oregon, also on behalf of Ray Miao, our AARP Oregon state president. And I'm going to defer to Mr. Rick Bennett, our director of governmental affairs, to address perhaps some detailed substance in terms of the bill. But let me start with thanking again the leadership that you've all provided. AARP Oregon is delighted that health and health care are front and center here in the legislative agenda. With over 500,000 members, ages 50 and above, we're consistently hearing that accessibility, cost, quality of health, and long-term care prescription drugs are top concerns for our members and the public at large and generations that follow. And historically, AARP has been pleased to see Oregon leading the way with policy innovations. These address our critical concerns, and we recognize there are indeed many roads to the same outcome and vision. And what we do share is quality health care for all Oregonians. Again, thanks, and we applaud your leadership for the individuals and the organizations that have all been providing the input and fostered the climate that allows for public and civic engagement. Rick will qualify my remarks, but I want to be very clear that I'm here on behalf of AARP to express our support for Senate Bill 329 as amended, as it provides a roadmap. We've agreed that doing nothing is not an option. Senate Bill 329 contains many of the very features that we all are indeed agreed upon and looking for in state health care reform, and we've previously shared our AARP principles with this committee and others regarding health care reform. And rather than read all of our written testimony, I just want to paraphrase the five from AARP that all of these points fit. That all Oregonians have a right to affordable, high-quality health care when they need it. That the financing of health care should be fair. That policies and technologies that save health care costs should be part of Oregon's health care reform. Individuals should take personal responsibility for their health and educate themselves and take preventative measures to guard against illness and disease, indeed try to enjoy healthy lifestyles and healthy life. And last and not least, persons of any age who have a disability should have a full array of services available to them. It's, again, to the credit of the leadership of this committee and all the interested parties that have been involved that this bill now addresses what we believe is the most practical approach the state can take. We have and will, as AARP, address other efforts that move us forward to our shared goals of affordable, quality health care for all. A quick example is our efforts in conjunction with others for the opportunity to secure health care for Oregon's uninsured children through House Bill 2201. We believe it's a very necessary first step for Oregon to take in this 2007 session. It is AARP's position that while Medicare is certainly part of the public discussion, it must occur for comprehensive health care reform. Such consideration and action must take place within the context of a national level. And as already noted by our current Governor Kulongoski and U.S. Senator Ron Wyden just a week ago, federal reprograms are going to require federal action. We all agree, everyone here, I believe, that the core problem is that our health care crisis is unsustainable due to the rise in health care costs. For that reason, AARP launched a major campaign movement just a few months ago called Divided We Fail. It includes business, labor, many strange bedfellows, as referenced before, that moves us forward on health care reform. And again, we will be delighted to provide our support in continuing civic engagement and dialogue at that national as well as, of course, the state and local level. I will now defer to Rick Bennett to address some of those caveats and support as well.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP. I've provided you with one sheet that has rather specific suggestions related to the language in the preamble. I've also provided some bulleted comments that explain those changes. If there are any questions later on those, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I have just a few comments and or questions related to the statutory language in the bill. And first of all, I'd like to speak to Section 5, which is related to the Trust Board. A few weeks ago, you had a discussion related to how that board might be made up. And I was very impressed with that discussion. Certainly, I would say that we have felt that the membership of that board should be primarily made up of payors and consumers. But frankly, the discussion really initiated by Representative Cannon related to perhaps another perspective on that membership, I think, was very good. And I agree with that. That in fact, you should be looking for board members who not only are knowledgeable, perhaps in one way or another, of the healthcare system based on their background, their professional position, and so forth, but individuals who are respected, who are trusted, individuals who have experience in analyzing issues, asking good questions, and obviously making tough decisions at some point in time. I think their product, the plan which they will submit to the legislature in October of 2008, will have a much better chance of moving forward if you have those kind of individuals who have credibility and the respect of those of us here in Oregon, that they are able to, in fact, kind of step beyond their perhaps professional responsibilities, their political affiliations, and so forth, and advocate for their plan. With that in mind, though, I think there was also a good discussion on Monday, also related to the board and its responsibilities, policy versus operational, full-time versus part-time, salaried, perhaps versus volunteer, and the term of office. As I envision the kind of individuals who I think you're looking for, I'm assuming that they have other responsibilities. They're accomplished individuals. I think that they will be motivated more for their commitment to the citizens of the state rather than what the salary might be, but also because of their accomplishments and other responsibilities, I think it's unlikely that they're going to be able to make a commitment to a full-time position as well. And so I know that's difficult to put something like that in draft form in a bill, but I would hope between the language in the bill and the record that you establish here that will provide good guidance to the governor in the appointments he makes. Section 11, the subcommittees. I've spoken before to some of you individually related to not necessarily handcuffing this board and allowing them to do their job, and in that respect, It's not necessarily specifically prohibited there, but I would ask that, of course, the board be able to establish other committees as they deem appropriate as they go forward in their work. Section 13, related to authorization in subsection 3, you did touch on that on Monday evening, and perhaps you need to provide more clarification related to the authority to implement any elements of the plan that do not require legislative changes or federal approval. Section 16, related to the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research. I just put this forward. I happened to run into Missy Dolan, who is the administrator of the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, and she was a little concerned because she kind of sees herself as being under that umbrella of the office, and so she was just curious as to how this change might affect what she's doing with the Prescription Drug Program. And lastly, Section 17 related to Certificate of Need. I understand that this is clearly seen as a cost containment measure, but I would refer back to the discussion related to Section 5 and the makeup of the board and what you expect of the board. And I think the Certificate of Need is clearly an operational function. And again, I just would ask you to give a little more thought as to whether that's appropriate with so much other responsibilities related to establishing policy. At least at this time in the first year of the board's work. With that, there's only one other comment I'd like to make. I'd like to take this opportunity to acknowledge the work of this committee. I've attended most of these, most of your hearings, as many of the others in the audience have done as well. I've found the discussion insightful at times, rather frustrating and confusing as well, and occasionally perhaps even reaching to inspiring. Certainly those of you on the Senate Healthcare Reform Committee, as well as members of the House Health Committee who have participated as well, you certainly bring to the table much knowledge and experience related to health policy and the state budget and federal financing as well. And you bring many different perspectives related to your professional lives. And some of you have very recent experiences related to being a consumer of health care. And what's been fascinating to me really is with all these different perspectives and knowledge and experience and so forth, I think it demonstrates that the issue is a very difficult one. It's a complex issue. It's one not easily solved, and finding the right path is not easy. But I do think this board does provide the structure to move forward on that path. And again, I just wanted to take this opportunity to thank all of you for your hard work and effort on this and your commitment to the issue. Thank you.
Rick did a wonderful job. I was supposed to be a segue here, co-chairs Westland and Bates, but distinguished committee members. But the fact is, he's summarized very well our awe of democracy in action and your leadership. We appreciate it. We dedicate ourselves to helping in that level of engagement. Realizing that we all share that goal of health and financial security. And again, to that end, without being too trite, you know, our organization has coined the phrase, or our campaign, Divided We Fail, but the tagline is amazing. We can accomplish amazing things together. And I think that you've been symbolic in terms of that effort. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rick, just one quick comment with regard to your sections analysis. I appreciate your comments on Section 5. Certainly, I think we've already got the language in Section 11 with regard to the subcommittees, not limited to. Perhaps we'll double-check that. And with regard to Section 16, the actual what comes over into the board, that we are very conscious. And you raise a very good point. I mean, these guys are trying to lift Mount Everest. The last thing they need to be concerned about is the administrating of a lot of extra state functions. So I think this
specific answer for Ms. Dolan and her prescription drug program at this juncture is she will be residing where she is for at least a while. But it's obviously a program, a policy that is going to be incorporated into the overall plan eventually.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I just wanted to clarify that I was kind of touching on a concern that she had voiced, but I would hope that you'd speak to her and get more specific information on that.
Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Incidentally, before I ask the question, I can tell you, I think we have defined how to pick the board members. They need to leap a building in a single bound, run faster than a speeding bullet, and find their way to Bethlehem simply following night sky phenomena. I think that will sort of solve the problem. I guess I'm the senior AARP member on the committee, having been a member for more than 20 years. And I keep hearing this assumption that a big part of the problem is phenomena in the last year of life, care in the last year of life, which strikes me as being, I don't exactly want to say ageist, but my experience has been that you're never quite sure when the last year of life is. And that if there's an underlying phenomenon that suggests we cut down on delivering care for people for whom it might be the last year of life coming out, that might relate to something you might all have something to say about. I wonder if I can give you a chance to comment on that.
Co-chairs Bates and Westland, Representative Greenlee. I'm going to respond personally, and if I swell up a little bit emotionally, it's because today marks the one-year anniversary of being at my mother's bedside about a week and a half before she died, at age 91, 5 months before my father at age 95 passed away. My parents were blessed with the promise of Medicare and Social Security and maybe some good genes. The fact is they had some significant health issues along the way. And I can rattle off a number of times that you and I might question, well, okay, at age 75 when my father had the stent put in, at age 85 when my father had quintuple bypass surgery, good or bad effective medicine? Evidence-based? Actually, we were told it was, but a physician working with in the place they had the surgery. So, I don't know how to respond to those that somehow know that magic of when is end of life. I think the bottom line is, in the case of both my mother and father, at 95 and 91, they both knew it was time. And in the case of my mother, Medicare provided the home health that had prevented the tipping point for about 2 years, so she was never hospitalized in spite of her conditions. And in the last few weeks of her life, Medicare provided the hospice care so that actually she was no longer in the hospital, but provided death with dignity. In my father's case, very similar. So, I throw an anecdote to you, but I can tell you that as an organization, our focus, too, has been on, you know, what's dignity, and that's why so often we're concerned about, well, what's the magic age? Again, one last anecdote is from my father. At 95, still denied he was a senior citizen. He was finally proud to say he was an AARP member, probably because his kid was working for him. But my dad always said, the senior is the person 5 years older than me. So I have to confess.
And if he hadn't had that quadruple bypass surgery at 75, it would have been his last year of life.
Yes, it would. Thank you.
20 years premature. Rick, you've been quiet about this issue.
I defer to my director on these.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question and a quick point. The desire for us to bring the Office of Health Policy and Research over to this organization was because we felt it offered some expertise that would be valuable to the board. And bringing it directly to them as a very special organization to bring over. It was not to burden them with more work. Obviously, there are parts of their Office of Health Policy and Research that really aren't as germane, but it's hard to separate one from the other. We brought it all over.
Your point about Section 17 is especially important to me. We do not want to burden this board, especially if it is a transitional board, with unnecessary work that actually diverts them from their work. Trust me, in the section we're presently in, I've been diverted from my work many times by things which were important, but really I need to get back to my main focus, which is healthcare. I would probably entertain that we have language here that says the board needs to have an ability to plan at community level and state level what facilities are and aren't needed. But I'm not sure I'm wedded to the idea of having, at this point, certificate of need embedded in the bill. So I take your recommendations very seriously, and I thank you for them.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Let's call up two of all of our favorite peoples, Ellen Lowe and Phyllis Rand.
Yay. The Mother Teresa.
No clapping committee.
Yes. Wild cheering.
Not till I'm finished.
The Mother Teresa's of healthcare in Oregon.
Okay. Good evening. I'm Phyllis Rand from Salem, Oregon. And I just want to give you a little background and who I participate with. And I'm a member of Northwest Senior and Disability Services Advisory Council, and this is a very important group to me. I also was appointed to the Commission on Black Affairs, and the Senate confirmed my appointment, and we've not met yet. This was almost a year ago. So I have a lot of concerns about that piece. And I thought I could really contribute to the commission, being the only non-black person that would be serving. And my years around the legislature, I thought that was an important piece. So I was disappointed that nothing has happened. And I've been given a choice that I could choose something else, but I don't really want to do that. Then, the last but not least board that I serve on is the Public Health Advisory Board, and Thomas Ashenbrenner is our chair, and I'm vice chair. So, and I've served on that board for 7 years. But I'm here today to share my thoughts on Senate Bill 329-2, because that's the most current. And I really want you to know that I'm in favor of this bill and have been waiting for years for my dream to come to fruition. So I really appreciate what you all, the time and energy that it takes and the thoughtful process that you're going through. Since 1982, when I went to work for Senior Services Division and the Governor's Commission on Senior Services as a legislative liaison, I knew that health care was at the top of my list for services that needed to be provided. At that time, people with disabilities had not been included with seniors, and I felt their inclusion to the department was a very important service. Entwined throughout all populations we serve, mental health and drug addiction is a service that needs to be provided for clients, but they've been underserved. And it's an ongoing issue, and I believe that they will be better served with Senate Bill 329. Areas of concern. What will the treatment list look like? Will the same reductions happen to this list of treatments when the money, when there's crunch time and there's no money to provide services? because we've already experienced what happened to the Oregon Health Plan, and I don't have any appetite for doing that again. We did it once, and it's unacceptable. Long-term care is first and foremost, and where individuals live and how they live on a 24/7, 365 basis is really important. Long-term care is a series of services and supports to assist individuals as they age and manage a disability, to live in their own homes and communities, or in a setting as close to that as possible, with as much control over their lives, is really what I'd like to see. Other advocates and I believe very strongly that long-term care should not be included in the acute health care reform. Medicalizing in any way these daily activities of personal care would be both inefficient and ineffective. Acute care is episodic and based on other factors than being able to do common activities of daily living, such as eating, dressing, bathing, and going to the bathroom. I strongly recommend that this bill be amended to explicitly exclude long-term care. Oregon has spent 25 years building the most recognized, most cost-effective home and community-based long-term care model in the nation. I just want to thank you very much for allowing me to testify this evening. And if you have any questions, nothing technical, you understand.
Mr. Chair, I do. The only caveat that I would say to your conclusion that Oregon has the best home and community-based long-term care system in the country is it has the best home and community-based long-term care system for people on Medicaid. Mm-hmm. There is basically no integrated private system for home and community-based long-term care services. I ran the social HMO for more than 20 years trying to find a way to integrate home and community-based long-term services with medical care in the private world, and it's basically a failure. I mean, at least now you can buy some services, but let's not get confused what we're doing under Medicaid with what we're trying to do
right
in the rest of the community for disabled people with disabilities.
And our recommendation is not to include, you know, Medicare. We want to leave that alone.
And home and community-based long-term care.
Yes.
Leave that alone.
Yeah.
That takes how much of, and Medicaid probably. That takes about what? 50% of the dollars? 60% of the dollars? Hard to not take those, huh?
I'd have to ask somebody about that.
Ask Ellen.
Yeah.
No, you won't.
Mr. Chair?
Absolutely.
Ms. Lowe?
Chair Westland and Bates and House members and Senate members of this, what has become a joint committee, I'm Ellen Lowe. And I'm here tonight just to talk about some of my experience in serving on a variety of boards, some planning, some regulatory, some administrative. And so I just wish to respond to the Section 5 where you talk about the board. And Senator Bates, you have mentioned the possibility of this being a transitional board, and that's what I came prepared to endorse. When you went through the amendments on Monday, I remember that Senator Morse raised the question about whether or not this, in effect, should be a policy group or at least there be some transitional description of what the initial function should be. And I would hope that that would be the case. In describing the board, I would put where you consist of seven members, I'd add the word public, because I really think that describes what you've been talking about, that really giving to the governor the responsibility of choosing people who would really reflect the public interest which you're trying to achieve. In terms of a transitional board or a design team or whatever you want to call it, I would also suggest that maybe you might like to have an additional size to that board. And I look at Senator Bates and remember that we served on an 11-member board for many years together, and I think it was a size that allowed us to really listen to one another and yet and be somewhat reflective, I believe, of the public interest of the state. I recall when the first board that I ever served on the statewide level was the Oregon Coastal Conservation and Development Commission, a mouthful that somehow Governor Tom McCall was able to add six public members. And again, that term was used, and I would just like to see that reflected in your legislation, so that indeed in their planning function that they will be representative as they in turn go out and work with subcommittees. The other thing is that you have mentioned the certificate of need section. If indeed you go to a more transitional or a planning board, I would hope then that you would look at other parts of the bill that might be more regulatory in nature, and you might wish to modify those to give more discretion to the board as they go out and assess the statewide needs. And so I brought with me Walden as one of my bedside companions, and the one of the quotes that I love: "If you have built castles in the air, your work need not be lost. There is where they should be. Now put the foundations under them. You are the architects." And so I hope that you can choose some good architects to help build on the foundation under those castles in the air that you have been part of. And I thank you very much.
First time in our committee's history we've had poetry. Well, Ellen, you're not getting away so easy.
Oh,
first of all, Phyllis, I've just got to say that with regard to your very poignant comment about having to disenroll people, many of us on this committee are sitting on this committee tonight because we were the ones that had to push the green buttons to uninsure 75,000 human beings. Mm-hmm. We did that,
yeah.
And people died.
Yeah. That's right.
So it's not a issue that we take lightly, and it's one of the reasons that the governor's Healthy Kids program is so important, because it adds people back to the standard program.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, thank you for sharing that concern. I would ask Ellen how her Giants are doing, but that's a cruel question. And
Chair Westland, since I don't have one of those little blackberries or whatever you call them, I don't know the score tonight, but we actually won last night.
No, well, that discredits your whole question.
Thank you so very much. Mike Huntington and Robert Hall with us this evening? And we've kind of got to move this along here.
It's Roberta.
Oh, Roberta.
Yeah.
And it's very clearly written. This is my misreading.
No problem. About half my mail comes that way. Okay, I'm Roberta Hall, and I'm a resident of Corvallis, recently retired OSU professor. Medical anthropology is one of my areas, and I've also taught in Canada and lived there for a number of years. Gotten interested in this topic in that way. So thank you very much. I want to thank the co-chairs, of course, for traveling around the state and making many, many visits that went into the wee hours and were very helpful. I attended the one, of course, in Corvallis. Just a few little concerns. I'm concerned in the bill about the link between employers and health coverage, which in one place it says they it wants to break that link. It should not be dependent on health coverage. I think that's on page 6, if I remember right. And I'm also concerned about the roles of the insurance companies. And another concern is about apparent splits between the people who lack pre-existing conditions that they know about and those who have not had any pre-existing conditions diagnosed. And I use those words carefully because how does one know for sure whether one actually is in a stage of illness or not? And I want to just turn to that part a little more particularly because I may have misunderstood it, or it may just be a clarification issue here. That's on page 12 under section 11. The G, number G, where it says excluding coverage for pre-existing conditions for a period of up to 1 year while permitting the individual's employer, or any person on behalf of the individual to purchase additional coverage for the excluded condition, and requiring accountable health plans to offer coverage for pre-existing conditions. That's what I took to have to suggest that those who have not had them diagnosed would adjoin such and so accountable programs, whereas those who in the last year have had some condition diagnosed in another group, and I'm presuming, but I don't know, and this is the clarification, that that one would be much more expensive either for the individual or the employer, or however that worked out. And so I'm wondering why everyone isn't pooled in the state.
Roberta, can I just kind of
sure,
answer your
please.
Concern and
thank
your
you.
Question, because that section deals specifically, everyone in Oregon would be included in the pool, and pre-existing conditions, you know, would not be any grounds for exclusion. This section is trying to get at those that come to Oregon specifically
okay.
for medical treatment and concern. We
so
know,
this would be the new residents.
Right.
Okay, very good. So am I right in understanding then that for residents who've been here already, that doesn't exist?
Exactly.
Very good. Thank you very much.
You
that's excellent.
Everybody, we're in good shape.
Good. Excellent. Just one other thing. I have been to, I'm a member of Mid Valley Health Care Advocates, and we've been running a number of discussions and talks over the last couple of years, and I've been to most of them. And what we tend to find is that, in general, the people are kind of way ahead, and our group way ahead of all suggestions, more progressive, you might say. And our people in Mid Valley Healthcare Advocates, we are very, very mixed. general population we have, being Corvallis, there are a lot of OSU people, or some, a few OSU people, they're physicians or nurses, people working in healthcare, people not, people retired, and younger people. And so I'm just very convinced that these people who attend these meetings and show some interest have a very strong desire for a privately delivered system with public single payer financing. This is what we pick up, what we understand that people wish. So those are my comments.
When Senator Bates and I were in Corvallis, we heard the phrase single payer more than we heard it on the whole rest of the trip. So you are, I'm sure, absolutely correct in your characterizations. Mike?
Co-Chairman Westland and Senator Bates, committee members, Senator Morris. I'm Mike Huntington, a recently retired radiation oncologist from Corvallis, and I represent physician advocates for sensible health care in Oregon and the nation, acronym PASSION. And we meet every other week and are very much supportive of the work that you have done on Senate Bill 329 and the many aspects that have already been mentioned. So I'll focus on what we think are still weaknesses. The pre-existing condition, I think, has been spelled out, but as I look at the wording, it isn't clear that it's somebody coming in from out of state that might take advantage of this. I think also of the person who gets the basic health care and then a supplemental insurance. So I think it needs to be clarified. If the line moves up or down on the priority list, depending on revenues, what happens to the person's secondary insurance? So it seems to be that should be linked, and that would be a suggestion. It might be easier if the carrier had to provide the secondary insurance if they're providing the basic health plan also. Let's see. I saw the notice about having a registry of advanced directives, and I like that. We like that. But could you make it a requirement that the advanced directive be filed by each participant? Medicare is not mentioned except as a Title 18 as a source of funds, and it leaves it that, yes, maybe that could be negotiated, but I think we should extract the stronger case that we want Medicare funds pooled. I think health reform will have a tough time. We won't have the funds needed unless we ask for it and go through the efforts of getting the waivers. How will pharmaceuticals be managed? Will there be a formulary? Will the health trust have the ability to negotiate for prices? And will there be a mechanism for continuous public participation in decision-making? Will there be a prohibition of underwriting for carriers that deliver the basic or provide the basic plan? I've lived through certificate of need, and I think it's a good idea. As mentioned by Senator Westland, there are 9 MRI facilities in Bend, and there seems to be no control. And I think if you have 2 units that are running at capacity, that's the justification for getting a third unit. And, of course, adding another unit adds more business. You keep filling up these buckets as you add more imaging units and outpatient surgery centers. I think this bill should stimulate a national debate on leading towards universal access, and that would involve Medicaid or Medicare. I think members of the health board should include public health experts, as Mr. Ashenbrenner mentioned. And in regard to the AARP witnesses, remember, they sell insurance. They may be
very concerned about those of us sitting on the upstream end of that canoe headed for the falls. I think if all of retirees and ARP members knew this crisis existed, they would agree to the wording in Senate Bill 329 and 27. I think we all know that the segment of the population older than 55 is now the wealthiest group. There are seniors who can't afford more for their health care, but there are many of us who can, and that Medicare should be means tested. In regard to end-of-life care, last 6 months, I know you can't determine when that 6 months is, but I think we should add quality of life, years of quality of life preserved as a criteria for that priority list. Maybe an 85-year-old person can have a stent placed or a coronary bypass, but we need to know where that fits on the priority list. I think our public resources are finite, therefore our services need to be finite. And so we need to put that on the list. Maybe we would still do it, but maybe we wouldn't. Thank you for your attention and all the work that you've done.
Good testimony.
Could, any chance you could speak to the employer aspect that I mentioned? What the linkage is? And I was pointing to this part on page 6. It says they want that it wants a defined set of essential health services for all Oregonians that is not tied to employment.
The issue is this. We know that to finance a system of this nature, no matter what nature you're looking at, you're talking about employers paying into a pool or paying for individual insurance, and employees taking part in that pool also. What we're trying to do is break the situation where if you move from one job to another, you'll lose your insurance, where your insurance is tied directly to that employment. There's room in this plan for self-insureds. There's room in this plan for individual corporations or companies or employers who want to maintain a healthy benefit, a robust benefit. But there's also a need, obviously, for getting a pool that will cover those employers that can't afford to be in a pool, that are too small to be in a pool, and produce a pool that is there for them. So it's still related to employment because that's where you have to gather the resources for this. But we don't want directly tied. So if you lose your job or you change your job, you don't lose your health insurance. You have the freedom to move amongst jobs. And when we talked to employers about this, we've gone all over the state doing this, we found out that I didn't meet a single employer that said to me, I don't want insurance for my employees. They think of, and the smaller the company, the more they want it. They're like family members to them, but they can't afford the premium anymore. So we're trying to devise a system that combines the best of what I consider both worlds. We want not to have socialized medicine, frankly. We want to have a system.
Socialized medicine is only two countries in the world that have it, but many other countries do have universal health care and single payer as well. So socialized medicine isn't necessarily and probably would never work here. I agree.
Thank you. Okay. And so we agree. Okay. Well, we want a system that has 100% access, that's universal, mm-hmm. and that people have choice in. And to keep those two elements going is how we help drive down cost. So we believe we devised a plan here that will give you the best of both worlds. 100% access, cost control, and health. That's what we're driving at and building on what we have in our system already and improving on it.
One of the situations that I'm very familiar with in higher ed, in both community colleges and colleges, is hiring people at 0.49 so they don't have to pay it. And many, many, many professors are in that situation and for that express purpose. So it one employer has both categories, and that's
Roberta,
one issue.
That's what we're really trying important. To get around here is employers that massage hours. So, thank you so very much.
Thank you for.
I'd like to mention, very disappointed that The merger has not happened. We hope that there's still a chance you'll still incorporate some of these items from Senate Bill 27.
Nope. This is the beginning of the important conversation.
Mr. Chair, can I ask Mike a question?
Yes.
Thank you, sir.
You want to ask it to Mike?
Who's Mike? Yes.
Yeah, come on, back up, Mike.
Yeah, I 35 years ago or so, when we were fighting for Medicare, the progressive position was we needed to include national health insurance for the elderly under Social Security, so everybody would pay in and be a part of it, and then would be entitled to it, having paid in through their whole lifetime. If we accept the notion that it ought to be means-tested in terms of getting benefits, in other words, everybody's not eligible anymore, I can't get in because of my income, would that mean I ought to be able to opt out of the payment system as well? I mean, if I'm going to decide to be rich when I get old, why should I be paying a tax for Medicare my whole life when I'm not going to get benefits? So I ought to be able to opt out of paying for it, right?
Well, I think it relates to Mr. Ashenbrenner's comment about, are we willing to sacrifice something for the common good? And it really gets beyond that. The people that aren't supported build up costs that we eventually have to pay for through unpaid bills at the emergency room.
Should we means test a single payer model as well? If you're a part of it, but if you have higher income, you shouldn't be able to get benefits under the single payer system. You should go off and do what you want, right? Same as Medicare.
I think so.
No universal access then.
No, it should be universal access.
Well, but universal access isn't means testing, right? Universal access means everybody.
Well, even in this bill, people who are getting the benefit package, the basic benefit package, will pay a premium. And I understand that will be means tested.
I'm not sure this bill's right. The question is, if you're talking about universal access, you're not talking about partial access, people who aren't rich. You're talking about universal access, which means everybody pays, everybody benefits. Isn't that your definition of universal access?
Well, right now, I think we're talking about universal access to a basic set of health care. It's defined benefits, whereas currently with Medicare, I think there's no limit on what you can get. If somebody wants to order an MRI for you, you can get it.
Would you be surprised if I told you seniors are paying more out of pocket now for their medical care than they were in 1963?
No, I wouldn't be.
So, I mean, it's not everything. They're paying a lot.
They're paying a lot, but in relation to people under retirement age, I mean, we're the wealthy category, whereas in 1964, we were the poorest segment.
Yeah, I got to say, Wilbur Mills once said in frustration, I mean, Wilbur Cohn, when I was with him at the time, said, boy, it's enough to make you lose faith in socialized medicine. Your comments are clearly that for me.
Maybe all after right. The meeting we can straighten this out.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Alice Dale.
Couldn't resist having a little.
Tom Chamberlain. Did we lose Tom? Thank you, Alice.
Thank you. So, co-chairs Westland and Bates and members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity of being here tonight. And as so many people have said, we really do want to commend you for the work that you have taken on. It is probably as important as any issue facing the legislature this session. I'd like to preface the comments I have by first saying that SEIU is committed to comprehensive...
Alice? Did you introduce yourself?
Oh, I didn't. I'm sorry. I'm Alice Dale. I'm the president of SEIU Local 49, and I'm also the area director for SEIU in the Northwest. So SEIU is committed to comprehensive health care reform, and not just in Oregon, but in our country. We support the efforts of former Governor John Kitzhaber's Archimedes movement, Senator Wyden in developing federal legislation. the Health Policy Commission's work that I sit on along with other members of this commission, of this committee, and the Senate Task Force on Healthcare Access and Affordability. We also, as a union, as many of you know, with the collaborative work we do with Oregonians for Health Security, have tried to help identify ways to save money in the healthcare system in order to make healthcare more affordable. So we believe that getting into comprehensive reform does require a lot of creativity. It requires a commitment and willingness to work together and to look at the greater common good. We have developed a set of principles which we've attached to the testimony that I provided. These are SEIU principles we've adopted in Oregon. They're the standards by which we will look at whatever healthcare reform packages eventually come out to determine our support. I wanted to limit my comments really to the Dash 2 amendments, and some of those have been answered, and so I will, in the interest of time, not go into those. First, that SEIU does support Senate Bill 329's goal of creating a program to provide coverage for a set of essential health services for all Oregonians. We think it's important, as we do that, to attempt to rely on services, interventions that require the fewest resources to get results. We think it's important to have a system of transparency and that there be a process for enumerating and updating a list of essential services. The second item we wanted to mention tonight is that to achieve the goal of providing coverage for all residents, we think the program should be decoupled from employment-based health care. And obviously the comments that were just made are, we agree with that. We think that there is a huge issue about workers who end up either between jobs or with an employer who doesn't provide health insurance and has an impact, obviously, on the health of those individuals. And so in SEIU, many of you know we represent a number of workers. Home health care workers are a good example of that, who come in and out of employment and coverage, whether through the state or through the Oregon Health Plan. And we think having an integrated delivery system where it doesn't change their access based on the change in their job or their eligibility for benefits is important. We were pleased that the original bill envisioned allowing working people to choose a health plan and stay with it regardless of employment changes. We're concerned that the amendments appear to maybe have modified that a bit. That does not, however, that's not consistent with what was just stated. And so I think we just would underscore maybe that the terminology used in the amendments maybe needs some attention. The third item, and this deals with the issue of pre-existing conditions, and again, I heard Senator Westland, your comments, and so I would just say that we think it is important to have a goal of providing coverage for all residents and to not have gaps in coverage in the form of waiting periods and pre-existing conditions. I understood you to say it really is just when a person moves in from out of state. A one-year waiting period probably is pretty serious, but the language, as we saw, the primary language, when I know that pre-existing conditions is reflected in several places in the amendments and the bill, but it wasn't clear to us reading it that it only involved an out-of-state move, so I think that, again, might be a place to just look at the language. The fourth item we wanted to mention was the issue of cost containment, and it does seem that that the committee, I mean, frankly, we go back and forth on this. There's one side of our analysis that would say create the board, let them do the work. There's another one that says if we're going to get into detail around cost containment, then let's go deeper with it. So I guess I would say, Senator Bates, your comment about maybe we don't have certificate of need in the bill, and that would be fine with us, but if we are going to have it in, then we think we should strengthen the certificate of need program in Oregon. And then other cost containment measures could be addressed as well, if the bill would have that level of detail. And so I just cite some here. It's in the testimony. But adopting treatment protocols and practice guidelines, requiring compliance for those as a condition of reimbursement, universal electronic medical records, denying payment for duplicative diagnostic procedures, denying payment when there is treatment for medical errors, establishing preferred drug lists and creating pre-authorization payment systems, making sure that there are reimbursement rates that create incentives for cost-effective delivery of services, adequate payment to encourage provision of primary preventive and chronic care services. I would underscore the earlier testimony that was provided. I think a lot of primary care physicians obviously do not get adequately compensated for the care they're providing today for a number of the OHP patients. Pilot programs to make sure that we're really looking at the use of non-physician staff where appropriate. There are a number of programs pilots underway today that are attempting to change the delivery of care so we can do it more cost-effectively. And then finally, requiring health plans to provide some of the basics that the PEB program is currently requiring of their insurers. So it would have patient screening, wellness and prevention services, chronic care case management, the integration of behavioral health and physical health services, electronic communications. I mean, we now have through email a lot of opportunity to prevent office visits and still address employee issues, patient issues. And then evidence-based formularies, reporting of patient outcomes at the provider and clinic level, and quality indicators at the hospital level. So I'll conclude by saying again that I really commend you both for the number of meetings you have had around the state, the accessibility you've created for people to speak to these issues in Oregon is really is pretty extraordinary. So thank you for your work.
Alice, thank you so very much for those thoughtful comments. You know, my first response is, as you get to 90% of what you're after under 4 sub B with, you know, a real effective transparency policy. That is, I want to say it's all the answer, but it's certainly a key component.
Yes, Senator Westland, I think it is enormously important, and it will, we think, change certain practices today if there is greater transparency.
Any questions for Senator Bates?
Good to see you again.
Good to see you.
She's my old landlord, so I have to be a landlady here. I have to be careful. I appreciate what you've done here, and you're talking really in 4 sub B about the heart of what we're trying to do. You're talking about accountable health plans and, quite frankly, accountable providers, of which I'd be one. So I appreciate this kind of thinking on it. I'm a little concerned that I did not see here something I keep going back to, and people are tired of me talking about it. It's preventative and preventative care and the care of long-term disease, preventing people from going to the hospital and getting into high-tech care. And that may well be in your principles somewhere else, but I'm hoping that you understand that's a key part of this also.
It is.
The PEB board understands that and is working that direction, too.
Yes.
So I appreciate your comments.
Okay, good. Yes, and thank you. Let me just mention, it's in that last piece under cost containment, Senator Bates, and I went through this pretty quickly, but we completely agree with that and think both of those need to be included.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Good to see you again.
Good to see you.
Thank you for coming. Jamie Piles and Laura Etherton. Jamie is from Lane County. I think she is the only individual from Lane County that's not at the Ways and Means hearing tonight. Enter and sign in, please.
Great. Thank you, Chair Bates and Chair Westland, members of both committees. My name is Laura Etherton. I'm the consumer advocate with Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, or OSPIRG. On behalf of OSPIRG, I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 329, the -2 amendments. And before, I just want to, I'll keep my comments as brief as possible. But I do want to commend this committee and the work of so many people here over the last couple of years for your dedicated work to improve health care in Oregon. You've taken on an enormous task, and we appreciate your tireless work to make this happen. I think the challenge, as you've discussed many times in this room, has been not just to envision the ultimate destination when it comes to health care reform, but to actually figure out the roadmap, get it going in the right direction, and start figuring out where the stops are along the way, and start walking down that path. And your work really comes at a critical time. Consumers, businesses, taxpayers, individuals across the state are facing very high health care costs, whether that is coming in the form of increasing premiums, co-insurance levels, co-payments, deductibles. This is a big problem, putting the squeeze on everybody, businesses and consumers alike. The and rising costs, of course, as we've seen, are pricing many people out of healthcare altogether. And as we've learned in our time together, this is actually raising costs even more as uninsured folks go to emergency rooms and raise costs even more, yet pricing yet more people out of care. I think that Senate Bill 329 takes some positive steps down that road to reform, and I want to specifically talk about our support for the broad principles in the Act and the goals of the board. It's very clear, looking at those goals in Section 4, that the aim here is to reduce the costs of healthcare, to improve safety, improve quality, get better outcomes, and bring that success to all Oregonians. And then in terms of specifics, I think the one of our recommendations would be to make sure that in Section 11, say, of the Act, where there are directions to the board and to the subcommittees to actually come up with those recommendations, that there are the directions and the tools in that section to make sure that the overall board can achieve those broader goals. And I think some of the comments you've just heard would be ones that I'd reflect as well, specifics on what type of cost containment to include in those delivery system reforms and in the benefits clarifications there, including standards for quality and safety of care as well. And then also looking at making sure that the accountable health plans, that the tools are there to really make sure that they are accountable, that the rates that the accountable health plans ultimately charge to the Oregon Health Fund and to consumers are, that there is oversight over that process, and that that process is one that includes public participation, where it is transparent, and where there are a number of factors taken into account regarding what those rates are to keep them affordable, not excessive, and absolutely reasonable in terms of what people can afford and the benefits that they're getting for those costs. I want to echo concerns about, as well, the pre-existing condition exclusions that are currently allowed in the bill, and I think it is the intention to make sure that this is really just not having everyone who is sick in the whole world move to Oregon to take advantage of this plan. I think it's the intent. The way we read the bill currently, it is a broad exemption for a year for any pre-existing condition and would allow that in some of the other pieces as well. So I think that will need to be tightened up to achieve the goals of the committee. But then I think it is also worth considering, even with newcomers to the state, is excluding pre-existing conditions going to help or hinder the board as it works to meet that goal of actually reducing costs? Or if the supplemental insurance to cover the pre-existing conditions, if the rates for those are too high, or people choose not to get that supplemental care, will we see some of that ending up in the emergency rooms again? And wanted to make sure we address that and don't get some unintended consequences, which I don't think is the goal here. Finally, I think we want to express our support for the thoughtfulness when it comes to coming up with the makeup of the board, that the Health Trust Board reflects this committee's intention really for that board to serve the public interest and to serve the people of Oregon, that the expertise and the technical pieces for the recommendations can come from the subcommittees, but that board itself is really there to bring these benefits to Oregon broadly. Similarly, support the work that board will actually bring the recommendations to public hearings and have a more statewide conversation about this. And then one additional piece that I'd raise is just as we move forward to consider how much authority this board will have to actually enact reform on its own and how much it will more serve as a very in-depth study group for the next legislature to grapple over again. And where is that balance of wanting to have legislative oversight over this board, and where really should the board be empowered to put reforms in place? I wanted to thank you again, Chair Westland and Chair Bates, and all the members of the committee for your tireless work to get to that healthcare destination in Oregon, and for and thank you for listening to me as I give my comments on the roadmap that we've got so far. Thank you.
Thank you. Enter and sign in, please.
Chairman Westland and Bates and members of the committee, my name is Jamie Piles. I'm a lifetime resident of Oregon. I live in Creswell. And I, for 9 years, I've been a member of a ministry, and for 8 years, I've been on the board of directors of that ministry. It's called Samaritan Ministries International, and it's based in Peoria, Illinois, and I'm here today representing those members and also the members of two other ministries that are very similar. One's called Christian Care Ministry, based in Florida, and another one is Christian Healthcare Ministries, which has its headquarters in Ohio. Combined, our three ministries serve a little over 500 households at the present time in Oregon, and in excess of 1,000 individuals nationally. We serve over 40,000 households and well in excess of 100,000 people. Our ministries offer an alternative to health insurance whereby members voluntarily help with each other's medical bills. As such, no cost shifting occurs with the bills. We merely share financially, emotionally, and spiritually with one another in these ministries. We're not insurance, as we don't take on any risk and we don't have any reserve funds. Our alliance of ministries are concerned that one of the things that you guys are dealing with here, obviously much broader scope than my little issue, but one of the things that you're considering is either possibly at the present time or especially in the future, you're considering instituting an individual mandate for citizens for the state of Oregon to purchase health insurance. And it's generally assumed by most that what we do probably won't fit your criteria as health insurance, and so therefore if that were to happen in its present state, our members would be in a real tough quandary trying to figure out how to deal with that. And if this were to happen on a broad scale, we would be in a sense legislated our demise. And so I'm just here to say we're a group of people who've kind of banded together in what I kind of call the old-fashioned American ingenuity. We've found a way to deal with an issue on our own, and in a way that doesn't require us to depend on the government or beg the government to solve our problems for us. And we've had a couple members of your legislature agree to sponsor some amendments if needed to allow us an exemption, to simply allow us to continue to operate. And I'm here asking you to give that strong consideration because we like to consider ourselves a part of the solution rather than a part of the problem.
Any questions for Jamie or Laura?
Yes. Actually, I do have a question. We heard testimony in the House Sub-Healthcare Access Committee this afternoon, and one of the questions as I was sitting here was, so what do your members do when they hit Medicare age?
Pardon?
When they hit the age of Medicare?
The majority of our members go on Medicare.
Okay.
Your chair?
Senator Bates.
Thank you. A couple questions on your program. I actually got a brochure from your lobbyist and read it through very carefully. I thought it was kind of a very interesting program. The key for me is that there's no cost shifting in your group, and that's your statement. Yeah, you're essentially a self-insured group, and this bill allows self-insurance. As long as there's no cost shifting, that's not a problem. The question I have to ask for you is, the way I read the information on it was it's a voluntary program and it works well for you. What about the patient who, or the individual in your group that has a terrible illness and has a $200,000 or $300,000 bill and no health insurance? Does your group guarantee that in some way, that that won't be cost shifted to the rest of the people in a given state or by the hospital that took care of them or by the physicians that took care of them? How do you deal with a catastrophic illness in this group?
Chairman Bates, good question. We don't give any guarantees at all because we are not an insurance company and we don't have a pool of resources. But within 40 days all our members in that situation, which has happened several times, not in the millions, but certainly in the six-figure. We have come up with amounts of money in the six-figure range, and one of the testimonies that I heard in the House committee meeting tonight was emphasized the probability that healthcare providers are very willing to sit down to the table and negotiate, and that's one of the things that does happen. And when we come up with that amount of cash in a short amount of time over the 10-year period of time, we've never had a healthcare provider be unsatisfied. We don't offer guarantees. We don't pool a resource of money, and we don't call ourselves an insurance company, but we are pretty happy with the way it works so far.
Thank you.
Question. Catastrophic illness, catastrophic accident, what happens? Do you take care of the catastrophic condition?
I think he answered that.
Well, it seems a little bit similar to the previous question, Senator Morissette. We have taken care of and satisfied every provider that's come our way in 10 years, and we have had several serious illnesses and catastrophic illnesses where we've come up with enough cash and with negotiation and with the opportunity for the rest of our members to step up and above and beyond the normal, we've been able to provide a satisfaction on every one of those times. I can't speak to the future. Obviously, you can imagine scenarios that could be very difficult.
I did meet with the representative from your organization and had a very good meeting, and I guess that would be the only question that I would have if you could possibly deal with even a series of catastrophic, but I totally support your effort. I totally support your request. I think it's great. I think if there is a larger catastrophic event or happening to a larger group, that then would be a different situation. But again, I think it's a self-insurance program. It's similar to others. I don't know that we're going to penalize other people who are in that situation, and so I think it's a great program. I think the Mormons do that to a large extent.
There are some programs.
Yeah.
Laura, Jamie, thank you very much for coming. Okay, the two we've been looking for. These individuals have traveled a lot of miles together, so I don't think they'll be offended if we call them up together. Mary Beth Healy and Dr. Evan Salino. I've seen these people in more remote cities in Oregon than any other two.
We could do another tour, Senator.
Yeah, exactly.
Anytime.
Dr. Salino.
Thank you for the opportunity to come to speak to you this evening. I recognize the incredible amount of effort this committee has dedicated to this critical issue and appreciate the chance to comment on recent amendments to Senate Bill 329. I particularly respect the leadership of Senator Bates and Westland pushing forward towards a plan to ensure quality, affordable health care for all Oregonians. As some of you are aware, I'm speaking to you from the unique perspective as a family physician who treats patients on the front lines of our health care.
Evan,
did you
yes.
introduce yourself?
I did not.
For the record.
Yes.
Okay.
Evan.
Hard question.
Yes.
Your name?
Evan Salino.
Okay.
Thank you.
We got it. On the first try.
I know.
Let's see your driver's
I studied
license.
A lot of years.
Yeah.
As I said, I'm a family physician, so there's medical school. Treating patients on the front lines of our health care crisis at a safety net clinic in Hillsborough, I see 50% uninsured patients, 50% Oregon Health Plan patients, and have realized that my patients who struggle and fall through the widening cracks in our health care system are symptoms of fundamental defects within that system. In a cruel reminder that 18,000 Americans and about 200 Oregonians that die every year because they lack affordable health care, I lost two of my patients, John, age 54, and Irene, a 47-year-old working mother of three, in the last year because they had a preventable malady, the lack of affordable health care and insurance. The problems that my patients face are the problems that all Oregonians will face, and I know that you understand this. If we fail to act, we can't afford health care now. What are we going to do about the future? Overall, I'm pleased that the amended Senate Bill 329 attempts to address many of the core problems in Oregon's health care system, and believe it's, if it's implemented appropriately, it will help control the root causes of the problem, rising health care costs. I'm also pleased that the amended bill incorporates some important aspects of the Archimedes Movement Senate Bill 27, although there are additional portions I would like to have seen. I understand from Senator Westland that this is a starting point for the discussion, so I'd like to briefly mention four major concerns I have with the amended bill, some of which have been mentioned previously. First of all, I'm concerned that there are no health care providers on the Oregon Health Trust Board. This is a critical oversight that I believe has to be addressed for a successful overhaul of Oregon's health care system. The board is essentially charged with redesigning the financing and delivery of health care in Oregon. Although those with finance, labor, consumer, and administrative expertise may be capable of addressing the first task, it's unlikely the board can successfully address the second task without any representation for those who have firsthand knowledge of health care delivery, health care providers. Possible provider representation on subcommittees I do not believe is adequate. The success of our future healthcare system relies on the three-legged stool of collaboration between healthcare consumers, payers, and providers towards a common goal, which is health. Participation and input from all are essential. Our past disregard of this triad of cooperation is the root of many of the current fundamental defects within the system. Viewing healthcare providers and consumers and payers as completely separate entities in a business transaction ignores the realities of healthcare and the fact that physicians take an oath swearing to advocate for their patients' health. It's critical that Oregon's healthcare providers have a substantial voice in reforming the healthcare system, in which we are the rate limiting step. We have no more conflict of interest than any other leg of the healthcare system. Second point, I'm concerned that the amended Senate bill doesn't address the financially unsustainable and medically illogical ties of Medicare that bind Oregon and America's future. The path has to be clear for Oregon to challenge a Medicare financing and delivery system that pushes increasing financial burden on the state via dual eligibles, shrinks health care provider reimbursement as the big stick to control rising health care costs. This is a system that is historically not paid for a patient's cholesterol screening test, but will pass on the cost of their heart attack and triple bypass to American taxpayers until the patient needs long-term care, and then they're on their own, until the taxpayers of Oregon pick up the tab when the patient's poor and disabled enough. Medicare is a system that forces patients and healthcare providers into financial and coding shell games to get appropriate care, and it's not medically or financially sustainable at the state or federal level. Any healthcare solution that doesn't ultimately address this elephant in the room will be a short-term solution. I believe Oregon can work within the ideals of Medicare and still develop a system that provides better patient care and can provide a more financially sustainable future for Medicare recipients. Third piece, I'm concerned about the timeline of the proposed board action. I am not sure why the board doesn't start to meet until January 2nd, or as a limit, January 2nd of 2008. Every year that we wait to begin implementing healthcare reforms, we waste billions of dollars and thousands of working Oregonians suffer. This is an issue of morality and an economic reality, and it demands immediate action. With the work that has been done and continues around the state, a sense of urgency the situation deserves, it's completely realistic and morally necessary that the Oregon Health Board meetings begin early this fall if this similar bill like this passes. The plan should be presented to the January 2008 short session of the legislature for evaluation and a vote. My patients and thousands of Oregonians around the state cannot wait. Fourth, like other folks have mentioned, I'm concerned about the language about pre-existing conditions. I understand the intent, but that's not stated in the bill, and so it's unclear. And certainly pre-existing conditions offer us no health benefit and end up costing us in physical cost and also financial cost when people put off care and delay care and then eventually get the care they need when they're really sick. Again, I appreciate the opportunity to address the committee. I'm grateful for your leadership again for tackling such difficult and politically touchy issues. I and all Oregonians are relying on you to push forward with a plan of action this legislative session that will be successful in providing a better future for all of us. Working together, we can use Oregon innovation and lead the nation towards more affordable, efficient, effective health care for all. Thanks.
Thank you, Evan. And let me just answer
maybe one of your concerns, your timeline issue. This is a perfect example of how the wheels of government grind slowly, but make an assumption that, you know, we get this bill out of here by, you know, passed, signed into law by the end of June. And the good news is we're very specific that the governor immediately points an executive director to start finding the office space and the phones and all that kind of good stuff. Then for the board, permanent or more likely transitional at this juncture, to be appointed, we have to wait for the Senate to come back into session. And that's probably October. And then you get the board. And then that board, you know, organizes and can start to pick qualified individuals to sit on the subcommittee. You have little things like Christmas and Thanksgiving in between there. So, yeah, I mean, I share that concern. If they can do it faster and maybe we can get kind of a jump. But just one of the issues that we deal with, and I say that, you know, is to point out the challenges and complexities. Like, why can't we just start this yesterday? There's issues. There's issues.
We would love to do it.
Yeah.
That's a good chair.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to put a little finer point this pre-existing condition that we've been asked about so much tonight. The language in the bill, and I'm going to go back and review this with legislative counsel, is designed to do this. If you're coming to the state for the only purpose of access, the only universal health care system in the United States, we have to put pre-existing condition in or we will go broke in a fortnight. If you're coming here because you have a legitimate job waiting for you, you have a job here, you've had a pre-existing condition, you have previous insurance where you lived before, or you came in without any insurance but have a job at Oregon, and your reason for coming here was that job, you're in. Okay? We just have to protect a system that is not a national system, which goes back to your Medicare discussion, and I fully understand that. I believe that discussion is going to occur someday, but I don't think it's going to occur because Oregon brings up the red flag on them. We've got to get done what we can get done here. And I think we can do a lot of what we need to do right here, right now, and prepare a system for the ultimate coming of Medicare. Okay?
Oh, God.
Why is
Hello,
he last?
Senators.
Well,
yes,
she
sir.
Signed up last.
I think she did it on purpose.
I did it so I could be with Dr. Salina, so I knew that he
I think
would
that,
be
know.
Running late.
But
in the interest of time, because it is getting late, and I think if I'm reading that clock late, it's almost later than we've ever been. But for the record, my name is Mary Beth Healy. I'm the Executive Director of Oregonians for Health Security. And as you know, we're a healthcare advocacy organization working to improve access to quality, affordable, and secure healthcare. So I just want to go through a couple of things. I want to echo the pre-existing condition thing just for the record, because there is great concern around that. In addition to the timeline, and thank you, Senator Westland, for kind of walking through that piece. But I would wonder if there is a way to do requests for the federal waivers around the Medicaid dollars, because that's a long process anyway. And do we have to wait till, I believe it's 09, to make that request? That seems like we'd waste an awful lot of time at that point. I would also say that, you know, to echo Mr. Ashenbrenner, that the time really is now. And I want to just bring back to us that this is an issue that you all know. It's consistently ranked as one of the very top issues in terms of Oregonians' minds as well as Americans. And I just want us to think about what the last year has brought us. There was the Senate Commission on Access and Affordability, co-chaired by the rest of you, on which I was honored to serve with Senator Moore, Senator Mona Sanderson, Representative Richardson, Representative Greenlich, and that, I think, really helped us to start this process on a parallel track. At that same time, I served on the consumer work group for the Archimedes movement, also moving down that same path. And then the Northwest Health Foundation started their collaborative effort, of which I was also honored to be at that table. And the great thing that I think is just important to reemphasize for all of us is that very divergent groups from varying interests really all coming together saying the time is now. We may have different little ideas, but broadly the issues around universality, the issues around a fair system of financing, those are key hurdles that we now can move forward on because there's such agreement amongst many. Not amongst all. There's still a ton of work to do as we find more of a product that hopefully this legislature will pass that we can then shop around, for lack of a better word, to Oregonians so they can buy in a greater way as well. And these tables were very valuable, I believe, for everyone concerned. I would like to take a second and just say that I applaud the goals of Senate Bill 329. I would like to think about more of the cost containment measures and what standards might there be that we could adhere to for the accountable health plans. Follow that for me, Senator Bates. Thank you. And that's one of the things that we are all committed to do. If we can't reduce costs, we're doing this, and it's an exercise in futility. And so I think we should have some stronger language in there around the cost containment mechanisms. I mentioned the timing on the waivers and other pieces that I think are in here a little bit, but maybe we could start earlier. The primary care home model. There's a number of other concepts that are in Senate Bill 329 that we might be able to move forward this session so there's something more, you know, it's the step thing as we get the board functioning and all the money pieces put together. I will say on the board piece itself or on the trust, the input of public members is really, really important. I just want to echo what others have said, including Ellen. I also do serve as the public member on the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool Governing Board, which is another reason why the issue of pre-existing conditions is pretty heightened in my head. And they already have a capacity question in that organization, so I worry about having many thousands more having to be added into that. So broadly, we're ready for a change. We're waiting for you. We want to work with you, all of you. And Senate Bill 329 really is a great start, and I look forward to passing comprehensive reform in the 2007 legislative session. Thank you.
Seeing there are no questions for Mary Beth, are there any questions for Evan?
Well, since we wanted some intelligent answers, we'll direct these questions to the good doctor. Seriously, Mary Beth, you bring up a point about the waivers I think really is quite germane. First, I think that for this board to go forward with waiver requests, it really has to have some blessing by the state legislature. I don't think they can go forward without that. Having said that, there is the outside chance that if the board has an opportunity to be formed quickly enough with enough expertise under it, they have a small window of opportunity to request waivers in the February session of the legislature. That is really pushing a timeline for them. But it is possible you might get at that point a authority to go forward and at least ask for waivers so that if those waivers are granted, they had to go back to the Legislative Assembly to implement them. So there's a slight chance there, but that's a really close and tight timeline to know what waivers you want to ask for. I could think of a couple right now, ending of categories in Medicaid, raising the federal poverty level across those categories to a specific number. And of course, the trade-off would be that we insure more people, that sort of thing. They might ask for something like that, of that nature, with the understanding they couldn't implement without authority from the legislature, which would be granted in 09. But I think you bring up a good point. There's a possibility of starting that waiver process early. We know we've never received a waiver from the federal government in less than 12 months that I know of. It's usually longer than that. It's a long, involved process, and one that can be difficult to navigate at times. So getting started early, if you know where you want to go, would be wise.
I hate to admit this. I like her idea.
I do, too.
I have a magic wand in the car. That might, you know, speed us up a little bit.
Any other questions for this panel?
I just want to say I want to thank Mary Beth for driving all the way down to Grants Pass to come to my town hall meeting and discuss health care.
Thank you, Representative Maurer. Always fun. It's a beautiful area of the state, really. Any opportunity to go south is good.
Both these guys are major road warriors. Thank you so very much. But, Evan, I have one more request of you.
Yes.
Could you please stand and face the audience?
I don't want to do this, Evan.
Let me warn you.
That'd be good.
This is just one of the best people that God ever made. He is absolutely... He's one of the most compassionate and human beings ever.
And he's a doctor. Imagine.
Thank you both. Is there anybody I missed? Or does anyone else want to testify?
I'd like to just mention a couple of points before we close.
Let's see. Anyone else want to testify? We're happy to stay.
Mr. Chair.
They're worried what I'm going to say.
Mr. Co-Chairs, I've been reading as in contemplating as we've listened to testimony tonight, and I'm on page 11 where we have subparagraph E at the top, and it says integrating streamlining functions of and programs administered, and we list all the various programs. I'm wondering if you intentionally left out PERS, which has three health care plans in it. As I look at the comprehensiveness of here, I thought I would see if you wanted to look at that. Okay.
PERS. It's in Public Employees Benefit Board. It's listed?
No, they're not there. But we have PEB, we have so many others that I'm just suggesting that you might want to look to see if you wanted the health care plans that are administered by PERS to be part of what is under the board, since you have everything else in the state, and not intentionally so. So I'm just mentioning that as a possibility. And the second thing is that I've gone through it over and over, and I can't see anything relating to health savings accounts or the ability or instructions for the board to assure that these are carefully looked at, along with tax deductibility for private individual purchasing of health insurance, since we're trying to get away from the tax deductibility model of the group insurance and employer-based plan.
Yeah, I think your question reflects a lot of what we've heard here tonight. This is kind of the yin and the yang of this. I mean, we're all hungering for just give us a plan. And yet at the same time, what we don't want to do is hamstring this, you know,
right,
not just the board, but the subcommittees that will be toiling furiously underneath it. And so, you know, for us to presume, as we sit here behind this dais, sure, we all have individual, you know, kind of priorities and wants and things we think are solutions. But for us to presume, I think at this juncture is just premature. I think health savings accounts work great for certain segments of the population. I think if we get to universality, there's nothing that precludes them. There's nothing that precludes employers from buying up. But, I will tell you, and there's so many different designs of health savings accounts. Fred Meyer, self-insured, they have one. Functionally says, you will go do these primary care functions, weight loss, smoking cessation, physicals, blood pressure, and we won't charge your health savings account. In fact, we will pay you to go do them. Not just pay 100% of the cost, we will pay you to go do them. So there's probably a long answer to your question, but there's so many variables, not only in the broader delivery system subcommittee and their charge and challenge. That's my answer.
Mr. Co-Chair, if I could?
Yeah.
I think that this Representative Richardson has a very good point here. Omitting some language referring to these two issues, I think, is important. The bill as it stands, as far as I'm concerned, has several areas need more work, but one weakness, and it's a weakness that's very difficult to get to, and that's individual responsibility. to hold down health care costs and get appropriate health care. And that is something that's very difficult to legislate, as you well know. An HSA, as an example, can be used for that purpose. I think it's something we should at least be referencing in the bill, as well as tax deductibility. So I think your point is well taken. And I'd like to talk to LC about it. I'd like to have you join me and talk to LC about that. I'd appreciate that. The other area we did not cover tonight, didn't hear a comment on tonight, is one that's very concerning to me. And I want to make it clear what this bill is trying to do. We are not trying to lay another layer of bureaucracy on this state, another layer of administrative overhead. We're trying to do the opposite. If this board functions the way we hope it will actually start combining different agencies, different bureaucratic overlies, and getting rid of them and simplifying how we go about obtaining health care in this state. Just looking at the list of things on page 11 gives you an idea of the problem. And that's not everything that's in state government. That we could make a list probably 3 pages long of all the bits and pieces that are regulated in healthcare and still not cover everything. The system has grown up slowly over many, 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 many years. And while all these things were done with good intention, as we all know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And folks, that's where we're at. So we need to pull this stuff out and have some way of pulling this stuff out in a reasonable fashion and devising a new and better system. And that's what we're trying to do here. I want to be very clear, this is not just another bureaucratic overlay. For if we do that, we're not getting anywhere. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Mr. Senator Morsette.
I did distribute a copy of something that I've had put together. My intern Fred Steele has been attending meetings, talking with individuals, pursuing something that I think is the heart and soul of the program, and that is the community collaboratives. If we don't have the community collaboratives, we do not have a plan. And I think we have to move in that direction. I'm not going to go through this in detail. I just want to call your attention to it. And there are models out there. 100% access in Lane County is a community collaborative. It's made up of many individuals, many entities. There's a lot of volunteerism involved. We need volunteerism in this program. That will make it go. People have to buy into it. There needs to be, the gaps around the state need to be filled in. There are some places where they have practically no collaboratives simply because of the distances and so on, so we have that work to do. But I just think the time has come, and this is something I've been talking about all along. We're building the foundation now, and I would like to have this health delivery and access subcommittee that would be added to the Section 11 that would deal with that. That would be their job. So I'll just leave this with you this evening. Fred has been working very hard. He's been attending a lot of meetings. The meeting that Mitch has set up on Tuesday, Thursday, he's been to them. He's talked with a number of individuals, and the resource list is on the last page. That's only part of the list. And he will continue to work on it, and I will continue to work on it. So thank you very much.
Bill?
Yeah.
I think Representative Richardson and Maurer and Cannon and Chair Greenlit are very much on this page, and they've developed kind of a three-legged stool bill that includes medical home and community collaboratives.
Medical home.
And it's I've read it. It's a very good piece of work, and it is by no means in any way, shape, or form exclusionary with anything we're trying to do in 3.9. And I've got to tell you, one of the things that most intrigues me about it gets to many comments here tonight, is that it really takes for small amounts of dollars, it really takes some large steps forward to providing access to uninsured folks today. I'm very encouraged by that bill and all your work. You've done great work with that. So we need to get you a copy of that bill.
I have a copy of it.
Yeah.
I understand what it is. I've been to some of the hearings. That's not exactly what I'm talking about. And that's one of my frustrations. There are collaborations going out there that are below the radar screen. There are people volunteering. There are a lot of things that communities have put together that we don't even know about. And if we're going to maximize our effort, we have to find out and pay attention and learn from them. The bill is fine. I think the community or the medical home concept is already out there, for one thing, and, you know, I understand what the concept is, and I think it's very complimentary. I'm talking about something even more basic than that. So, anyway, I will continue to talk about it.
Well, this bill, it's a grant application process.
Yeah.
So some of these that we don't even know about, your key phrase, accurate, you know, assessment, what's out there? It's one good way to find out.
Okay. Thank you.
Any comments for the good of the order? I appreciate the intrepid committee members and audience attendees that have stayed for our longest and one of our best and most productive meetings. I appreciate all of you being here. We are adjourned.